and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. I've been looking forward to talking to her. Her name is Gloria Loring. She's an actress. She's a writer. She's a singer. She does everything. Is there anything you don't do?
Windows.
You don't do windows? I mean, you're so multi-talented. And when they say multi-talented, there's so many things you do.
Well, I think I've always wanted to share my heart. And whatever way I get to share my heart is terrific. I decided early on in my life that I either wanted to be a teacher or a singer, as long as I was up at the front of the room.
Right.
And I've wound up being both, actually. So I've been a yoga teacher. This book has a lot of great teachings in it, my new book, and I've been an actress, and, you know, so it's all good. I had a great life.
I didn't mention the title of the book. Coincidence is God's Way of Remaining Anonymous. It's out from HCI.
Quote by Albert Einstein.
Right. Who would have known that?
I know. You know, that's what, when I first heard the quote, it was as I was talking to someone like you, an interviewer, and I was telling the story of how I'd raised $1 million for diabetes research because my son had diabetes, and I created the Days of Our Life celebrity cookbook, and
right.
How this little card that said expect a miracle showed up quite mysteriously in my dressing room at Days of Our Lives 24 hours before I met the benefactor who helped me raise $1 million. And I said, out of that story, I said, isn't that an amazing coincidence? And he responded, yes, but then you know coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And in that moment, my ears perked up, and I said, oh, wait a minute, let me write that down. Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. It was such a big idea, and I had no idea what it truly meant, the depth of it. But what it started me on was I started to, you know, when you hear something really good, you start to repeat it whether you own it or not. But as the years went by, I started to see this series of extraordinary coincidences that was happening in my life that led me to comfort, that led me to healing, that led me to people and circumstances that I longed for. And at one point, I just realized that this unfolding of my life was not that unusual, because I had talked to enough other people and mentioned that saying, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And every time I mentioned it, people, either they would say, absolutely, oh, yes, or they'd say, oh, wow, wait a minute, that's cool. Repeat that? What is that?
Exactly.
So I knew that there was some nugget of great truth there. And it took me a long time to write this book, but now here it is.
And there's lots of little nuggets in this book. That's what I like about it. It has made me think a totally different way about my life, about what makes people happy, you know, what we should do to be happy, you know, because our heart is telling us things, and maybe we're not listening to our heart. Maybe we're listening to the wrong thing.
Well,
or the wrong person.
Intuition, the inner form of coincidence, is always speaking to us. That's we would call it our higher self, we are connected to the magnificent intelligence and creativity that created all of life. We're told that by all the great beings, by Jesus, by Buddha, you know, by the Quran, the indigenous peoples, that we are connected to the great spirit, and the great spirit moves in us, and in this we live and breathe and have our being. And yet, we so often, most of us spend most of our lives, I think, feeling separated from that magnificence. And it was as I started to notice coincidence and plumb some of the depths of this subject that I saw more and more how we are connected to what we need to know and what we need to grow, what we need to expand. By grow, I mean expand. Let
that sounds
go of
so,
our limitations.
It really flows nicely to hear you say that.
Yeah, that came to me a couple weeks ago in an interview. You know how I'm an extrovert. I don't know what I'm thinking until it comes out of my mouth. You know?
I know that feeling. I've been guilty of that myself.
Yes, yes.
Sometimes you can't take it back, and you suddenly realize, oh, idiot, why didn't I realize what I was saying, you know? Well, we've all done that at some point or another.
Yes, what's that wonderful little homily or little metaphor about words that fly out of your mouth are like feathers from a pillow on the top of a mountain, you just can't gather them all back and put them back in the pillow.
Right. Now, you've been writing this book for a while. I mean, this is more than a few years' worth of work for you, right?
I started writing it, it took me about 12 years from the time I started it to the time I said, okay, yeah. Well, you know, the good things take some time to marinate,
right,
to mellow.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I started it, and then I wrote it, and I wrote my stories first, just my personal experience. And, of course, I had a lot more to learn.
And it's not a tell-all book either. I mean, you're not out to get it, you know, to tell tales about your fellow actors or actresses or anything.
No, I'm sure the Inquirer wishes it were, but it's not. No, but there's enough insight. I mean, a number of people have said I was quite courageous, so I guess there's something that's a bit of tell-all.
Right. But it's like it must be cathartic, have been cathartic for you, too, to write all this stuff down and to be able to share it with people and to open up your heart. I mean, we get to see exactly what goes through your mind a lot of times. I mean, how you make decisions and what happens.
Yeah. Well, the process became more and more fascinating to me the more distance I had from certain events in my life. You know, sometimes it's that forest for the trees, you know, we're in the midst of something and it's struggle, and then we get through it and we look back maybe from a year or 5 years or 10 years and you say, wow, that was so hard, but you know what? I learned so much. That was, you know, I call them the angels of adversity. Mm-hmm. There are people and circumstances that come into our lives that they really ask a lot of us. They challenge us. And yet I think that that is also that magnificent intelligence and creativity that many of us know is that word God, that's beyond our knowing.
See, I was always taught if I didn't believe in God, I'd go to hell. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
I was too, you know. And
I mean, what a horrible thing to teach a child, though, that they could go to hell if they don't have any belief
in God. Or that they're supremely sinful and cannot be redeemed except if they do certain things and, you know, skip to Malou, my darling, and all of that.
But watch everything they do in their lives and be, you know, careful what you say to people, what you do to people, and how you treat people. And
well, there, you know, there is great sacredness in becoming attentive to what we do in our lives and how we conduct ourselves. But I don't think it's a matter of falling into the pit of forever damned. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, the original meaning of the Greek word for sin means error. It means mistake. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are not, so in that form, yes, we are quote-unquote sinful because we make lots of mistakes. We are learning, you know, a child learning to walk. You know?
Your definition of mistake, though, I mean, what's a mistake? I mean, is it a mistake to be gay today? I mean, of course, certainly I would never say that. But some people would say it is. I mean, it's like everybody has a different definition of what's a mistake.
Yes. And perhaps the only true mistake, but again, a mistake is a temporary thing. Yeah. You know, a mistake is an error on a test. Yes, some people think it's an error to be gay, perhaps, except, hello, we know that the brains and the physiology of people who tend toward same-sex relationships is actually different. So that means that the creative intelligence that created the rest of us created those beings. So I don't think, my own, you know, people like saying, oh, it's a mistake to be black. Excuse me?
Yeah.
It's a mistake to be, come from the Aleutian Islands. You know, it's a mistake. No, the magnificent creativity that's responsible for all of this has a great playful sense of humor and keeps, that's what evolution is. It's that playful sense, ooh, let's put some more feathers on this bird after 100 years because it's in a colder climate now. And, you know, I mean, evolution is God at work. I don't know how far it goes. I'm not schooled in that. But evolution is working in our lives. we evolve, don't we? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm basically the Gloria, except I would have been the Marie, except somebody named me Gloria.
Well, are you a different Gloria Loring than you were when you were on the soap opera, when you were on Days of Our Lives, or are you the same basic person, or have you opened your heart?
My true self, I'm always, you know, you could call me anything. I'll give you an example. My grandson, Nana's rascal boy, his name is Tyler. He has renamed himself Jet Thick Five. His name is Tyler Thick. He is now Jet Thick 5. Hmm. And I have no idea why, but I asked him why, and he said, well, because it's cool. So he's 4.5. He's taken on this other identity, and, you know, a rose by any other name would still smell as sweet.
I wonder how long that'll last. I think it's
I know,
so cool.
We'll see. Well, he was Amazing Alex for about 7 months. So now he's Jet Thick 5. He's trying on different identities. But, yes, am I the same? I'm the same, and I'm different. My body, my physiology, my cells have all replaced themselves since I was on Days of Our Lives, so I guess I'm absolutely not the same, but I'm the same consciousness. I'm the same being that came into this life before she knew her name. I'm a piece of the cosmos, I guess, a partner with the cosmos.
You seem to grow every time you learn something. I mean, just from reading the book, I get the sense that every time you come to a crossroads and can't decide something, when you do make that decision, it seems to help you grow in some way, and you open your heart more.
But isn't that true for all of us?
Yeah. Well, hopefully.
Well, yeah, or we don't. We keep doing the same thing over and over
right.
until it gets so painful. It's, you know, I mean, we're all, in a sense, like an alcoholic who has to hit bottom, and maybe it's in a relationship, or maybe it's in, you know, our not exercising, and finally we go, oh, this is really not working. I can't climb a flight of stairs. I'm tired of this. You know, sometimes things have to get our attention in extreme ways in order for us to be willing to change.
Right.
But some of us... I was in so much pain, so much interior pain.
Was? Yeah.
Not now, no, there's no pain. There's almost no pain at all.
No neck pain, certainly.
Hmm?
No neck pain, of course. You mentioned your neck, and I love that chapter about the neck.
I thought,
well, we've all been through that, with having neck pain, you know.
I know, but wasn't it fascinating that, and for those who are listening, in the book I tell about a series of esoteric experiences that came to me, where I kind of shouted up to the universe, I'd had a year and a half of neck pain, and I was just finally fed up. This is hitting the bottom, right?
Right.
And I shouted like a little prayer. I didn't know it was a prayer, but I said, okay, I'm really tired of this, and I need you to fix this. And within a short period of time, like a week or 10 days, I was invited to do a past life regression with Dr. Brian Weiss, the leader in the area of past life regression. And I went in, it was for a television show, I went in, I did the regression.
That's fascinating, yeah.
And my neck, once we discovered I'd been hit in the neck with one of those ball and chain kind of things, and it was 1027 AD, and somebody could say, oh, you have a really good imagination. Well, why after a year and a half of chiropractic didn't cure my neck? Was my neck cured in 10 days after being regressed? You know, I mean, I've read so many books on it now because I'm fascinated now.
Yeah, you read a lot of self-help books. I mean, I'm just reading the book.
I'm fascinated by people and how we work.
Well, when you typically read a self-help book, do you know pretty much right away whether it's really going to help you or whether it's not going to help you? I mean, because there's so many out there. I mean, where do you even turn?
Well, you know, reading a book about self-help is sort of like reading a book about wine. You actually have to drink the wine.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I met the meditation master, who, by the way, I'm 99% positive, this is the very same one that was spoken of in Eat, Pray, Love. It's the same woman.
I like that
India.
Movie. I'm one of the few who really love that movie.
Oh, I love the movie. I love the book. But when she took me into... and not personally, I was in a room with 5,000 people, and suddenly I had joy and bliss and champagne bubbles of ecstaticness floating up to my eyes and tears filling my eyes and big smile on my face. I thought, what is this that's inside me that is coming up when I'm in her presence? And so I went and took these meditation intensives. I talk about this in the book, and had these experiences that the love that I had always wanted.
What do you hope
inside me?
Right. What do you hope this book's going to do for people? I mean, it certainly inspired me. It certainly made me think about how I decide whether to do things or not. And I mean, it makes me feel very introspective and very. When I'm reading it, I feel like I'm experiencing something I've never experienced before. Some kind of
knowledge. Oh, there's no higher compliment. The fact that my journey, which you know, I condensed a journey of probably 30 years. You know, 25, 30 years into one little 200 and whatever page book. So it's very rich and very deep, and the experiences I talk about and the truths that I share, not just out of my own mind, but out of all these great beings.
And all those beautiful songs you wrote, too, that are in there. It's amazing.
Yeah, this is probably the first book ever with its own soundtrack. Every chapter has its own song, and the songs are all contained on a CD called Turn the Page.
Oh, I have to get that CD.
Yeah, you know what? I'll have to send it to you. You send me an address, and I'll send you the CD as well.
Oh, I would love that. That would be wonderful.
Absolutely.
I guess they're so beautiful, the words. I mean, they just... And you write in the book about how you wrote some of them and how you agonized over some of the songs because you wanted them to sound really beautiful.
Well, see, and there, like the song of my father. A song of my father I actually wrote before I discovered that there had been what I... gracefully term highly inappropriate sexualized experience with my father that actually shattered my sense of self in some ways. And it took me a long time to repair that, but once I knew about it...
But it can be repaired, though.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, it can. We can get down to our original self.
That's very hopeful for... there's a lot of people out there going through that, I'm sure,
I've heard from a lot of women who read the book, and they may be in their 50s, 40s, 50s, and they're saying, I'm just now starting to face what was done to me as a child. I put it aside. I thought, I just won't think about it, and it won't have any power over me. But in truth, it does. It does, because it's hidden and it's buried, and a therapist I know called it, it's like the hamburger in the closet that's been sitting there, and it's rotten and it's stinky. And we walk by the closet and we say, oh, God, it stinks in here, and we spray the Febreze and we, you know, we clean down the other surfaces, but we don't want to open the closet. But sooner or later, the stench of it permeates our life. And then when we're ready, when we're strong enough, then we face it.
And you always feel a little bit better when you do, when you actually talk about it, when you let it out a little bit. You know.
There's wonderful research showing that just writing or talking, writing is very powerful too, journaling, talking to a compassionate, speaking with a compassionate witness, someone who will take your part and say, oh, that's terrible. I'm so sorry. Who will... It's sharing the burden, and somehow that lessens the burden. That's why therapy can be so valuable for people.
Mm-hmm. I remember being hypnotized when I was in therapy, and I still remember to this day how powerful it was. I mean,
comes up that you didn't know was there.
Yeah, exactly, and you don't even think you can be hypnotized. I mean, I thought, oh, this is crazy. Nobody can hypnotize me. And before you know it, you're in this trance, and you know it's very powerful.
There's a lot more to this life than we see with our eyes and hear with our ears.
Well, what makes you happy today? What, as opposed to what made you happy, say, when you were on Days of Our Lives?
What makes me happy today?
Obviously, your family, because you talk a lot about your family.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of joy there.
A warm shower in the morning, my vanity table and all my makeup, my doggies, reading an incredible book and seeing someone else's heart on the page. Seeing a great movie and seeing actors open themselves up to sharing from the deepest part of themselves. Beauty anywhere, everywhere. Snow coming down, the rain when it comes, blue skies.
So you can appreciate life a lot more now than you could before. Is that true?
Yes, because I know that I read this, who was it from? Marcy Shymoff. I know this to be true. I have to bring my happiness to the situation instead of waiting for the situation to give me its happiness.
Wow. That's a very powerful statement.
It's my responsibility to bring that vibration, that resonance into what I do. Enter with a smile, not wait to see if somebody's going to put a smile on my face.
All right. You were on Days of Our Lives for 6 years?
Yeah, 6.5 years, yeah.
Now, that's grueling work. I mean, you learn, I don't know how many pages of dialogue a day, 5 days a week or however.
Sometimes we're 20 or 25 pages. They're not hard to memorize, usually, if they're well written. Sometimes it was 40 pages. That was tougher.
Right.
It was okay. I have a photographic memory, so it was usually not a big deal for me.
Right. I always wonder how they do that. I mean, it just seems like such tough work. I mean, and you got to be on your toes all the time. You got to know when to talk. You got to know when your actors are talking. You can't talk over them. So you have to know the whole scene.
Well, yes, you have to know your scene, absolutely. I remember once I was in a scene with Quinn Rediker, who was a very popular actor on the show.
Who I just found out recently wrote The Deer Hunter. I didn't know that.
Yes, he was a screenwriter.
Is that amazing?
And Quinn and I were doing a scene, and I said something wrong, and I went, oh, that's wrong. And he said, now we're on camera, right? Mm-hmm. And he looks at me and he says, don't say anything. If you don't tell them, they don't know.
Where is Quinn Rediker today, I wonder?
I don't know.
Have you kept in touch with all your co-stars?
No. I have a little contact now and then with Bill Hayes.
No, he's a wonderful man.
He's a darling man. And he and Susan have just written a book, and he's still out singing. He's in his 80s. He's amazing. He's so full of life, and he always was one of the most gracious people. He was very, very helpful to me in my early days on Days of Our Lives. I would be struggling with something, and he'd so sweetly take me aside in the hallway, and he'd say, you know, when you do that, if you want a little tip, I said, yes, please, you know, because
right.
I was so new to it. And he would give me these little tips that helped so much.
Well, we know people care about us. What a difference life makes. It really does.
Yes.
Sometimes we don't always know it. I mean, sometimes I think to myself, you know, I don't hear from somebody, and I think, well, maybe they don't care about me anymore. But it's just, you know, it's just life is busy, and people are busy, and, you know, they don't always get the chance to tell you.
Yeah, and sometimes it can be our job to initiate that and just to write a note to someone and say, we haven't talked, or send an email, gee, we haven't talked in so long, just miss the sound of your voice, let's try to catch up sometime. And even if you don't do it, the fact that they'll write back and say, yeah, absolutely, you go, okay, connection. It's very important.
I love the part of the book about the makeup. Was it a makeup lady or a man? I can't remember.
Oh,
I mean, it's so real. I mean, it's something, you know, you think, oh, my goodness.
That's the chapter, The Uses of Coincidence. Yes. She was tough.
You stepped on her toes, and you didn't realize you were doing that.
But part of me did, you see. That's how I... See,
you mean you did it?
We're in a relationship that is difficult. We've played a role in creating that relationship. Because we noticed that person, we may have responded to them out of fear. We may have done exactly the thing that would prompt them to attack us. And once we realize, and that's a whole long chapter about that, about how we participate in that, and how I participated in my relationship with her.
Mm-hmm.
We can start to change that. We can watch for those signposts.
Right. And it's just amazing. I love reading that kind of stuff, and I think, wow, you know, you never know when you're going to offend somebody. It can happen just like that, and you realize, wow.
Our very presence can offend someone because they see something in us, most likely, that they're not allowed to be. Oh, could she just, like, calm down and not be so friendly? Well, maybe they were told, now, don't, you have to be careful with people. You can't give too much of yourself away. And they actually resent the fact that you are such and such, or, you know, that you're such a way. And, I mean, it's all just stuff. It's just stuff. My teacher said, you know, when someone gives us feedback, we have to really contemplate it. And what part of it belongs to us, and what part of it belongs to them? Because, you know, some of it may be their projection onto us, but some of us may be a truthful criticism that we could take, you know, under advisement.
Do you think we all want to be happy? I mean, do you think everybody would be?
Why do you think there's drugs and alcohol and food and clothes and shopping?
But, I mean, you know, sometimes it seems like there's people that just don't want to be happy. No matter what you say to them or do for them, they just are not going to be happy people.
Yeah, they may believe they may have gotten more attention being unhappy than they got being happy.
Yeah.
You know, they're, you know, when children act out and they get more attention for being bad than they get for being good, you know, then we prime them to act out. So, you know, we have to send people like that our it's so nice to send people like that our compassion.
Right. And you seem to do that very well, opening up your heart to people. I mean, you do it in the book, and you certainly show how you can do it to other people, and you know, and show people that you really care about them.
Well, I am a very important participant in creating the life that I have, and as I mentioned a little bit ago, it's my job, my biggest job, is to bring my true self, my happiness self. As a baby, you know, those shining eyes, innocence, new vision of life, to everything I do, to bring that happiness. You know the joy that children have, you know, it's a puddle, and they'll splash and splash, and life is fabulous, and, well, you know, for us, it might be, ugh, a puddle.
Yeah, right. As you get older, you think, that puddle's dirty.
Puddle.
But children don't see that. They just see the fun involved with it.
Well, yeah, and life is so much fun. I mean, you know, we might complain about moving all our stuff instead of saying, wow, am I ever lucky? Look at all that stuff I have.
Uh-huh. What's been the toughest part of your life so far? Or have there been any tough? I mean, obviously you've been through.
Yes, there are tough.
Well, what was the toughest part? Was there any time where you just feel like you couldn't take it anymore?
One of the toughest parts was my son's diagnosis with diabetes when he was 4. I think
Do you blame yourself? I mean, do you blame as a mother?
Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, parents blame themselves for lots of stuff that really isn't their job. You know, you think you're supposed to be able to protect that child from everything, and then suddenly you realize you can't, and it's a great blow to your heart and to yourself.
Well, how long did it take you to really accept it, to really come to terms with it, and be able to?
I think it takes about a year to know that it's there, and you slog through it, and you protect your child by taking care of them with the diabetes. Now, I think a turning point for me was that I was thinking that Brennan's, you know, flawed somehow now, you know, that there's something wrong with him. And at some point, I don't know, out of some innate wisdom I was given or graciousness, I realized that he was just as perfect as he'd ever been, but his perfection now included diabetes, and that somehow we would make good of it. And we did. I mean, Alan and I joined the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation. We raised money. We raised awareness. We empowered Brennan by putting him in touch with other people who had diabetes. You know, that's one of the things I say, is that even the most challenging and devastating of coincidings of meaningful events, coincidences.
But you've been hit with a lot.
Offer us an opportunity,
right,
to step into a greater way of being.
But the fact that you've been able to overcome a lot of things, does that make you a stronger person, do you think? Do you think you're stronger today because of that?
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, sure, aren't we? Aren't we all?
I think so.
I mean, it's not like, you know, I had polio at 4 and I've been in a wheelchair ever since. I mean, my God, there are so many people who have overcome and triumphed in such tangible ways. My overcoming, but I think there's value to each of us overcoming. There's strength in each of us overcoming. You know, the person who hasn't had a drink for 27 years, oh my God, that's an amazing amount of strength and discipline and inspiration. I mean, we are everywhere, those of us who are heroes. Every one of us has been a hero at some point in our life. Something that scared the holy bejesus out of us, and we did it anyway. You know,
have you ever come worry? You talk about worry in the book too. I wonder if you've sort of
overcome.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Worry.
Yeah, I do. I do worry sometimes. Sometimes my head gets all caught up in something, and I go, you know, round and round on that carousel of the same information passing before my eyes and trying to solve the unsolvable. Usually I go and I meditate, or I just tell myself to stop it.
Right.
Stop it.
I still remember Alan's, he was on Growing Pains, of course, we all know that.
Yes, yes.
And there was an episode, and I wish I could see this episode again. I haven't seen it in years, but where he was trying to help this next door neighbor girl who wanted to commit suicide.
Oh.
It was a very, very powerful. To this day, it stays with me because it really affected me in a lot of ways. Just that one episode. I mean, a lot of the episodes did, but that one in particular. And I haven't seen it since. I've tried to find it online, and I'm sure you can get it somewhere. But
But Alan's got a good heart, and I'm sure he brought his heart to that scene.
He did. He did. You were never on Growing Pains, were you?
No.
You've done a lot of different TV roles. I mean, you were on, I think, Beverly Hills, right, at one point?
Beverly Hills 90210,
yeah.
I did a guest role, and I did a bunch of guest roles.
I think Fantasy Island, too, right?
Yes, did that, did a hotel with Barbara Streisand's husband.
Oh, James Brolin, yes, absolutely.
Yes, yeah, I did a bunch of those things, and that was good. It was very good.
Now, do you still do any acting today?
I haven't been doing it for quite a while.
Do you miss it?
Not so much. I think it would be great to be in something where I got to really sink my feet in the mud of it, where I would play the same role and if it were an ongoing series of some sort. That was the fun about playing on a soap opera or like a sitcom, because you really know your character. Guest spots are very difficult. You walk in, everybody else knows everybody, and
right.
You're the new kid on the block, and now you have to, fit in there, and it's a very, very demanding
situation.
It's
like going to high school for the first time.
Pardon me?
I remember going to high school for the first time.
Yes, it's like going to high school. Yes, everybody else belongs, and you're the new kid on the block.
And you're just like, I don't know anybody here. I'm scared to death. What if everybody doesn't like me,
Yes,
we all have
exactly.
This, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've always had this thing where I want people to like me. But, how can you? You can't force people to like you. You just have to be, who you are. And
I kind of had to let go of that. And just, as same way about bringing my happiness to something instead of waiting for the something to give me happiness, I bring my liking people to them, and if they respond in kind, that's fine.
Now, you taught yoga for 7 years?
Mm-hmm.
What does yoga do for somebody who's never done it before?
Oh. Well, first of all, you have to have the right teacher, and the teacher... we're talking about hatha yoga. Hatha.
How do you know who the right teacher is? I mean, how do you know?
Well, a teacher who, first of all, will spend a little time with you before your first class, who will ask you if you have injuries, if you have difficulties, who will, during the class, be sure to come over and say, let me give you an adjustment on that, let me show you an easier way to do that, who will not just throw you into some power yoga stuff and expect you to keep up no matter what happens to your body. Yoga should be, first of all, non-harming. There are yamas and niyamas as part of the system of yoga philosophy. And those are the things that you should do and the things that you shouldn't do. And one of the things that you shouldn't do is do anything that harms another, and that includes yourself. So part of yoga should be non-harming. And unfortunately, there are people who have mixed up the Western capitalist competitiveness of our culture here in the West with yoga, and feel like you have to compete with your neighbor and do just as many chaturangas and dandasanas and all of that.
Yeah.
So it gets to be too much. A gentleness with ourselves and to meet ourselves where we are. I always wanted my yoga students, I would tell them to go to the first edge of resistance and stay there and breathe, and then see if they could, if the body would allow them to move more deeply. And that's a great way to deal with our own feelings, our own grief. Teaching Hatha Yoga taught me a great deal about being a person.
Now, when you started doing it, how soon was it when you started seeing results and seeing things change? I mean, I assume your stress levels went down after you started doing it.
Well, I first started doing yoga when I was 19 in New York City. For about 6 months, I went to Swami Satchitananda's ashram in New York, and I would take yoga, hatha yoga classes, and I would sometimes go to his talks, and I always felt very calm and smiling. happy when I finished listening to him talk. There was something just very sweet about him. I never remembered what he said, but I always felt good. Mm-hmm. And yes, I would finish an hour class and feel like I'd had a 3-hour nap. There was just something so, there's something so kind and thoughtful about bringing the breath, the body, and the mind into coherence, into association and harmony with each other.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, it sounds beautiful just hearing you talk about it. I mean, I can imagine the feeling of what it's like to go through that. And what
it's like. Yes. There's a wonderful, by the way, for people who are listening, there's a wonderful video I just saw, and it just brings tears to your eyes. It's called Never Give Up, and it's on YouTube. And it's a man who was almost 300 pounds, who'd been a paratrooper, and jumped from parachutes. His knees were shot. He walked around with two canes and leg braces and a back brace. And in 10 months, he lost 140 pounds and completely cured his knees. He now can run. And, I mean, the transformation is absolutely unbelievable. And what he did was yoga.
That's amazing.
I mean, yeah. You should look at it. It's really inspiring.
And those are always the ones that, and I love watching YouTube and just crying.
I know.
Cry. Don't we feel great after we've cried for a little bit? I mean, it's such a great release. At least it is for me. It's always been.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love the family reunion ones. I love watching a good family reunion.
Oh, that wonderful one about the two young men and the lion that they saved from Herod's that's been shown everywhere on The View.
Yeah.
And it's got like millions of hits. This fellow, the Never Give Up video, I believe has 7 million hits, 7 million views.
Now, have you ever done any videos with your yoga? I mean, have you ever thought of doing a video?
No.
Sort of like Jane Fonda did with exercising?
No, I haven't done that. I didn't proceed to the level of senior teacher and all of that as much as I might have wanted to. It was an avocation, not a vocation. So I just let it be what it was, teaching my two classes a week and
you took over somebody's class, I think. You mentioned that in the
mm-hmm.
book. I took over
her class and started teaching even before I had my certification because they needed a teacher.
What was it like the first day? You must have been a little scared.
But see, I had taught... the story in my book is about our yoga teacher, Annie, who passed away quite suddenly after a surgery, probably from an aneurysm
like
that.
Yes.
And we took over her class, and of course we taught exactly as she had taught. And so I had a systematic approach. We were there to remind each other, and there was one of us who stood up at the front of the class and led. But I did that for about 6 months, and then I moved away to the mountains, and within a couple months was asked to take over a class. So I just continued doing what I had learned from Annie.
You just dive right in. You're not afraid to try. Is there anything you're afraid to try?
Skydiving.
Well, I don't blame you. I'm scared. You'd have to push me out of the plane to get me to do that.
Oh, no. You'd have to throw me out of the plane.
Well, we all have fears. I mean, and fears tell us something, I guess. I mean,
driving around in a car is scary enough for me in Los Angeles traffic. God, I don't need to dive out of a plane.
So what are your days like today? Like, tell me what you did today.
I get up, I make my chai tea, I meditate in the mornings, I have uplifting reading, I have about 4 books that I read, I use Daily Word, I use a great teacher, someone just gave me his book, and it's Daily Contemplations. Sometimes I write a little bit, but I do meditate. I have these half-hour meditations I do. I walk my dog, feed and walk my dogs. I get on the computer and book all the interviews for my book promotion.
Right.
I talk to friends and family. I go to Pilates and work out.
Now, how often do you speak? Do you speak?
I speak at different, every month or so I'm doing something. I'm doing something this month. I'm doing 2 things next month. I'm doing something in March.
You really stay busy.
I stay busy enough, you know, at this stage of my life. I love my quiet. I love living in the mountains. I love to travel, though. So my life has a lot of variety, and I've always liked it that way. I'm very much an entrepreneurial spirit.
I love the part in the book where you say most of the time you like to talk, not listen. She's so honest about it. I mean, it's like, I know I talk a little too much, too. People will tell me, oh, you talk too much, or I talk too loud, you know. And course, it always makes you feel embarrassed when you hear people say that.
Well, I've learned to be a better listener. When I'm supposed to be listening now, I can actually tell myself to shut up and listen.
That's right. No, you've done it very well for this interview. Very well.
Well, thank you.
And I kind of knew you would. Just listening to your voice, it's just very soothing to hear what you have to say, because you have a calming influence somehow. I feel calmer.
Well, I think
just
it's all those years of teaching, you know, and now I'm in touch with that within me. Most of the time, I lose it now and then, and then I go, oh, okay, get back on track here, girl. You know.
But, at least you know what you're doing. I mean, at least you realize that you've done something wrong, and you have to go back and do, you know.
Yes.
So you know,
I have to regather myself. Yes.
I mean, your self-awareness has grown exponentially. It sounds like.
Yes, but you have to practice that awareness. Yeah. Yeah, you have to practice. You practice consciousness. You practice peace. And the more you practice peace, I mean, remember, I didn't tell this story in my book, but my mother years ago...
I love that last part about your mother. That was
Oh, yes, but this was before that. This was 7 months before she passed, and she went in for a surgery. They were going to put a stent in her heart because one of the valves was closing down, and the doctor came out. We were waiting there, my sisters and I, and he said... What's happened? He said, well, he said, her heart would not let us put the stent in. I said, huh? And he said, no, it would not allow it. So this is her body's decision. I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, she has between 2 weeks and a year. We don't know.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and he left, and we had to now go in and see her in the recovery. And, of course, we were, you know, tears in our eyes, and I said, okay, let's. And I just led us into a meditation, and we quieted our eyes and quieted our hearts. We didn't say anything. I just said, let's just breathe. And we found our peace. We found our calmness, and we were able to go in there with smiling faces and no stress and talk to my mom, and she was very funny. She had just come out of, you know, all of this surgery, and she said, come here. She beckoned with her finger, and she said, I'm hungry.
Now you don't mention your sisters in the book. You have how many sisters?
I have two sisters. My one sister Peggy died 8 months ago. I dedicate the book to her. Yeah, I dedicate the book to her. Actually, 9 months ago now. I to my sister Peggy, who faced whatever life asked of her.
I didn't realize that. I may not have asked. I didn't realize.
No, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know that.
And you have another sister?
Yes. My other sister, Patricia. Yeah, she lives in Northern California.
Now, does she do yoga also?
No, I don't believe so. She's got a lot of injuries and very difficult times, so I don't believe she does that.
So what's the future hold for you?
I don't know. I want to be the healthiest person I know and the day before I die.
So you really don't. You wake up in the morning, you don't even know. I mean, you know what's supposed to happen, but you don't know what could happen either.
I know what I'm responsible for. I'm responsible for the way I bring myself into the day. I'm responsible for what I allow myself to dwell on in my thoughts. I am responsible for taking care of this body. I'm responsible for all my relationships. And
you're very sure of yourself. I like that.
Well, I know at this point in my life, I'm not waiting for life to make me happy. I know whatever is going on can be a source of contentment for me. I remember reading years ago that contentment is the hardest, most difficult spiritual practice. No matter what's happening, to say, okay, I'll accept this. And I think it's really important because these are my hours and my days and my weeks and my years. And if I can't be happy now when I'm healthy, and when my family is all around me and I have a beautiful home, what if I lose?
Right. Now, where are your two boys? Do they live near you?
Well, they live in Los Angeles. I live 2 hours away.
Okay. So how often do you get to see them?
Well, actually, about every 2 weeks and I spend Nana time. We do Camp Nana.
Oh, great.
And we try to get the two little ones together. And I have plans for them on Saturday. We're going to make turkey burgers and, you know, play in the yard and all of that.
Wonderful.
And, yeah, it's good.
You have a good life, I can tell.
I do. I'm very grateful for it.
Now,
I'm very grateful.
Are you going to write another book?
I have ideas that have already been put down. It's called Lessons from a Soap Opera, How to Drop the Drama. Because I've become an expert in it because I had so much.
That's right. Well, it's been a wonderful, I've really had a good time talking to you.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. Now, be sure to send me your address.
Oh, I definitely will. Now, the new book, again, is called Coincidence is God's Way of Remaining Anonymous.
Yes.
Reflections on Daytime Dramas and Divine Intervention, Gloria
yes.
Loring, HCI Publications, and it's in all your bookstores now. And I don't know, is it available?
It's on Barnes & Noble, and my website, GloriaLoring.com. There's a button there that takes you to an ordering page. And, yeah.
Well, you're very inspirational, and thank you for helping out.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. It's so nice to talk to you.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.